From MainePublic.org, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, October 19th, 2016. And on this day, Maine State Auditor determines that the State Department of Health and Human Services improperly managed more than $13 million in federal funding, but agency officials disagree. Meanwhile, families of those with intellectual and developmental disabilities urge DHHS to abandon a proposed rule change they say will harm their loved ones. And conservation groups say two significant fish kills in Ellsworth and Brunswick illustrate problems with the dam owner's plan for fish passage. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
I'm Barbara Caridi. State Auditor Pola Buckley has notified several state officials, including Governor Paul LePage and Attorney General Janet Mills, that the State Department of Health and Human Services, quote, improperly managed more than $13 million in federal funding. As Mal Leary reports, agency officials disagree.
In an unusual special letter to state officials, the state auditor questioned the transfer of funds earlier this year. But in a statement, DHHS says the transfers were properly done and that the audit was politically motivated. Buckley's term ends this year, and she is seeking another four-year term. Westbrook Representative Drew Gattine co-chairs the Health and Human Services Committee and believes the transfers may be illegal and that lawmakers should consider tighter controls on agency spending and contracting. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Meanwhile, families of those with intellectual and developmental disabilities are urging DHHS to abandon a proposed rule change to services. At a press conference today in Augusta, the families said the changes will force providers to cut back on services, which will harm their loved ones. Patty White has more.
One of the biggest concerns families have is that the proposed rules would change the way providers are paid. Cullen Ryan, who has a young adult son with disabilities, says the net effect will be less money for service agencies that are already underfunded. And that's already had an impact on his son, he says, who has had to say goodbye to support workers over the years who've left for better paying jobs.
37 people have come and gone in my son's life. They have been there long enough for him to get to know them. And then they have abandoned him. And each time it has left a gap because it was then hard to fill that position. And my son languished without support over and over again.
Ray Nagel, the executive director of the Independence Association, says his agency has a 40% turnover rate, and other agencies in the state have a 60% turnover rate. He attributes the problem to declining reimbursement rates.
From 2007 until today, we have effectively had more than 30% reductions in the rates. And you can't sustain staff with rate reductions.
With providers already struggling to retain staff, Karen Humphrey of Auburn says other aspects of the proposed rules further jeopardize services for her adult nonverbal son who has autism.
The most troubling policy in the rule for me is that if DHHS deems that an agency cannot keep a member safe, they will give the agency 30 days notice, then stop payment to the agency.
But those same agencies aren't allowed to discharge a client unless there's a safe place to send them. That could force them to continue to provide care without reimbursement. And Humphrey worries that will prompt service providers to decline taking on more challenging clients in the first place. These problems, families say, could have been avoided if DHHS had collaborated with them when making the rules. And that was their expectation after DHHS scrapped another controversial proposed rule change last spring.
We've done quite a bit of communication.
Ricker Hamilton is Deputy Commissioner of Programs at DHHS. The department held 5 meetings across the state this year and also had separate meetings with providers and stakeholders. The proposed rules, Hamilton says, were written to comply with federal standards.
We're all about person-centered choice and effective and efficient. And I think what's happening, in my opinion, in some of this is that this is looking for providers to have to change their business model.
And now, he says, those providers are falsely alarming families. Hamilton says DHHS will accept written comments on the proposed rule change through October 29th. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
And amid the LePage administration's efforts to move funds around and tighten services, state revenues are coming in higher than budget forecasters had predicted. After the first 3 months of the budget year, revenues are more than $32 million above estimates, says State Finance Commissioner Richard Rosen. The reason, Rosen says, is a strong summer tourism season.
So all in all, we're seeing good economic activity that is resulting in revenues coming into the state that are, at the end of the first quarter, running over budget.
Overall, sales taxes are 7% higher than a year ago, with auto sales and meals and lodging taxes all exceeding projections. In addition, Rosen says, corporate income taxes are up 20% over estimates, while individual income taxes are on target. And on this day, a group of small business owners launched a TV ad campaign in support of Question 4 on the ballot, which would increase the minimum wage.
It was important that we paid a living wage because nobody should work full-time and have to live in poverty.
There we go.
That's from an ad featuring business owners Adam Burrill and Tony Jambro, who run an auto repair shop in western Maine. Also featured is Michael Landgarten, who owns a clam shack and two other eateries in southern Maine. The Yes on 4 TV campaign is sponsored by the Maine Small Business Coalition. Director Will Eichard says the group wants to show that business owners in Maine do support higher wages.
Corporate lobbyists who represent Wall Street and the national chains would like to tell you that all business owners are against fair wages. Adam, Tony, Michael are examples of the hundreds of Maine businesses and business owners who know that raising wages is good for this state.
But not all business owners believe that raising the state's minimum wage from the current $7.50 an hour to $12 an hour by 2020 is a good idea. Conservative advocacy group, the Maine Heritage Policy Center, says passage of Question 4 could result in the loss of more than 14,000 jobs and lead to a significant rise in the cost of goods and services. Voters will decide the referendum question on November 8th. Coming up, are Maine's 800 students enrolled in the state's two virtual charter schools keeping up with their peers in traditional schools? We take a look. Conservation groups are raising red flags about what they say are two significant fish kills in Ellsworth and Brunswick over the past week. They say both illustrate how the dam owners' plan for fish passage isn't working. As Susan Sharon reports, they're also frustrated with what they say is a lack of response from federal and state fishery regulators.
Dwayne Shaw of the Down East Salmon Federation says staff and volunteers first noticed dead alewives showing up on the Union River below the Leonard Lake Hydro Dam in Ellsworth about a week ago. Many appeared to have gotten struck by the blades of the dam's turbines. So Shaw says they then reported the problem to federal and state agencies, including the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA Fisheries, and the Maine Department of Marine Resources.
We're not getting any response from either the agencies or the power company as to what they intend to do to prevent this from continuing. We understand that the same situation is underway down on the Androscoggin.
That fish kill near the Brunswick Topsom Dam is estimated to have killed thousands of out-migrating fish, says Ed Friedman of the group Friends of Merrymeeting Bay. Friedman says he personally went to the site over the weekend and documented and photographed several hundred dead fish himself. His group has long been working to ensure safe fish passage for migrating fish like endangered Atlantic salmon, shad, alewives, and eels. But Friedman says fish passage at the site remains inadequate.
The only way for fish to get by there without going through the turbines when there's no spill over the top of the dam is through an 18-inch little downspout pipe located right next to the turbines.
Both dams are operated by Brookfield Energy, which has been the subject of at least one similar complaint in the past. A spokesman for the company declined to talk on tape, but in a written statement, Brookfield said it is, quote, constantly working to minimize the potential environmental impacts associated with our operations and activities. Brookfield said it is in communication with Maine regulators to modify operations when needed as a way to avoid fish mortality. Dwayne Shaw disagrees with that assessment. He says Brookfield, which is in the process of relicensing the Ellsworth Dam for 30 years, has not taken corrective action to protect alewives and other fish.
Our volunteers have really stayed on top of the situation with alewife migrations in the rivers down east, and they're doing a lot of work up and down the coast to restore alewife movement, to restore the commercial fishery. And in this case, it's very frustrating to have a hydropower operation standing in the way of restoration.
Calls to the DMR and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service seeking comment for this story were not returned by airtime. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
Across the state, about 800 middle and high school students wake up every morning, log on to their computers, and take all of their classes completely online. They're enrolled in Maine's two virtual charter schools. This year, that same online approach is also being used by brick-and-mortar schools. As Robbie Feinberg tells us, the track record for online and blended learning is mixed nationally. The question now is if Maine schools can buck the trend.
Hi, guys.
For Tiffany Jones, teaching English only requires a computer and an internet connection.
Can you hear me? Can you guys give me a green check if you can hear me? I'm not using my headset right now. There you go.
Jones teaches at the Maine Virtual Academy, the state's second virtual charter school. From her cubicle at the school's headquarters in Augusta, Jones speaks into a little microphone on her computer. Students answer on her screen with text, emojis, or little green check marks. Jones says she's worked in brick-and-mortar school districts from Lewiston to Durham. But despite being physically apart from her students, she says she's never felt as strongly connected with her kids before. For her, it comes down to communication.
You know, texting my students, I'm, you know, watching my son's soccer game and I'm at the field and Susie's asking me a question about her paper. I'm like, oh, write this sentence instead. Or
when students are struggling, Joan says she now has the time to reach out, schedule a meeting, or talk through a problem with the family.
So far today, what time? I don't know, it's like 10:30 in the morning. I've talked to like four different parents on the phone. It's more of a team effort with the family.
This is year two for Maine Virtual Academy. It was the second virtual school approved by the Maine Charter School Commission after Maine Connections Academy. Together, the schools enroll about 800 students. And like a lot of charters, both are particularly alluring for kids who fall outside the norm for whatever reason. Students with jobs, musicians, or many who simply struggle to fit in at their old school. Jones says schools like hers can make those students feel comfortable and connected. But that promise sometimes doesn't lead to performance.
Student performance in these programs, and student retention for that matter in these programs, tend to be abysmal is probably the nicest descriptor that I can come up with.
Michael Barber studies virtual charter schools at Sacred Heart University. He and other experts say lower test scores shouldn't be too much of a surprise because of the demographics these schools tend to serve. But he says the numbers nationally are jarring. A 2016 report from the National Education Policy Center outlines the problem. It says that less than half of virtual charter schools were judged academically acceptable. Maine's virtual schools, meanwhile, have had their own problems. In its first year, the Maine Virtual Academy saw more than a quarter of its students leave the school over its first 90 days. In addition, last year, both virtual schools had some of the lowest participation rates on state standardized tests. That makes it tough to properly evaluate student progress. Maine Virtual Academy head of school Melinda Brown says that among many changes instituted this year are the creation of a more consistent system of academic plans school-wide and the offering of more test sites.
Our hope this year is that, you know, we're going to offer a lot more test centers across the state, but there will be a MEVA teacher at every single one of those test sites.
The academics, meanwhile, have been mixed. Officials are encouraged by the Maine Connections Academy. It met most of the goals outlined by the Charter Commission over the past 2 years. And experts say its contracted provider, Connections Education, has seen reasonable success nationwide. However, the main virtual academy, which contracts with provider K-12, hasn't seen the same results in its first year. According to its annual monitoring report, less than half the school's students met their projected reading growth on the NWEA standardized test, and less than a quarter met that growth in math. The school says it's created new programs to support students, particularly in the summer. And Mike Wilhelm with the Maine Charter School Commission says those numbers aren't concerning yet and should be looked at as a baseline for future growth, and the commission will keep monitoring the school. But for a glimpse at the next step in virtual learning, referred to as blended learning in Maine, you can head to a school along the shores of Messalonskee Lake, the Snow Pond Arts Academy.
Now angle that body forward, slightly diagonal.
The classes often look like a scene from Dirty Dancing. Every morning, students spend 3 hours learning music, theater, and dance. The school was designed as a way to offer any kid in Maine a chance at a quality arts education, particularly in the face of cuts to many local programs.
I love this. I love this modern day.
The school's strength, says Principal David Hollinger, comes in classes like this one called From Book to Stage, where student groups act as theater companies and design their own versions of classic stories. One group is adapting Humpty Dumpty as a Renaissance period piece aimed at kids.
So we found out that Humpty Dumpty was written right in the middle of the French Revolution, so that was a big inspiration.
Yeah. We pulled different, like, times. You know, we pulled things from, like, the Renaissance and from, obviously, the French Revolution, and it's just kind of a mix of a bunch of different time periods.
Principal David Hollinger says the goal is integrating arts to make subjects like history more engaging.
So there's a lot of those connections that can help build the academic component of the school as well.
In the afternoon, students pull away from the stage and head to their computers. They go to more traditional classes, science, math, English. The school uses the educational provider K-12 to provide the curriculum, with teachers meeting with students one-on-one or in small groups. Academic department head Corinne Coughlin says this lets her be more creative with how she delivers ideas to her students.
And then I can be innovative and bridge, you know, from the core academics to the special interests on the art side of things. So music interests, dance interests, theater interests.
Students at Snow Pond seem to love the arts curriculum, but their response to online learning is mixed. Some enjoy the flexibility, but others, like freshman Nevaeh Shuchart, say the transition has been hard.
Well, I had my moments where I thought I was going to leave because of K-12, but then I was like, the arts is like on your path to the future, so I'm kind of sticking through it.
Do you feel like you're learning as much right now?
No, not really.
Michael Barber, the Sacred Heart professor, says these blended programs don't have a track record of success. But he's intrigued by Snow Pond because it's aiming its classes and content at a specific kind of student with a passion for the arts.
And I think that's probably the best way to start.
And even with these questions about both virtual and blended learning, state officials say they're nonetheless excited about the school's potential as a new educational option for students who are struggling in traditional classrooms. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And an effort to revitalize Waterville's downtown is about to get a big boost. Officials announced last night that the Alphon Foundation and Colby College will each give $10 million to the effort. Colby Communications Director Kate Carlisle says in 1929, when Colby wasn't sure of its future, the community raised the money to help buy the college a new site for its campus. And now it's Colby's turn to give back.
Now Waterville is in a position where the mills closed some time ago and the downtown has become a little less vibrant. It's time for Colby to really see how they can partner with civic leaders and nonprofits and arts leaders and business people to help Waterville out.
The $20 million in funding is part of a collaboration by Colby, Waterville, and downtown businesses to revitalize downtown Waterville. That money will be used for projects including the redevelopment of the former Levine's clothing store as a hotel and construction of a new student apartment complex downtown. The college and developers have purchased several buildings in the area for renovation. And finally, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
Such a colossal final crumb of summer weather for all but the county, where temperatures were a bit spring-like this afternoon. Temperatures will relax this evening. Under moonlit skies, will drop back to the 40s for most, 30s far north. Tomorrow will be a cooler, tranquil fall day. Bright sunshine early, gradually yielding to thickening clouds by midday in the St. John Valley, not until dusk down east. Showers will envelop the mountains late, 50s to near 60 statewide. Friday, damp and mild for all. Morning fog will be followed by light showers, interspersed with moments of mist, mid-50s north to middle to upper 60s south. Low pressure swinging underneath the belly of New England Saturday will generate significant rain. Although certainly not a drought quencher, the heaviest will fall western, central, and northern counties. The rain will exit southwestern Maine late in the day as winds stiffen. Fall returns with a vengeance Sunday. Considerable cloudiness for most, mountain showers and flurries. Partly sunny south with penetrating northwest gusts. 41 to 50 north to south. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public.
That's the news on This Day in Maine, Wednesday, October 19th, 2016. Robert Holt composed our theme music. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina, and to Mal Leary, Patty White, Jennifer Mitchell, Robbie Feinberg, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mainepublic.org. I'm Barbara Caridi. For all of us here at Maine Public, thanks for listening.